At Emory University, we believe in those with the ambition to achieve, the passion to learn, and the optimism to see the possibilities ahead. Founded on a belief that the wise heart seeks knowledge, an Emory education combines experiential learning in Atlanta and beyond with unrivaled collaboration and discovery, all to prepare you for a world that needs your leadership. Learn more at emory.edu.
Welcome, everyone, to another episode of Kiwi Talks. My guest today, some would say, is the big cheese of IGN, the co-founder, the EVP, the CDO. Some would also argue the MVP. And he doesn't really seem to age. Pierre Schneider, how are you?
I don't know. Not only do I feel old, I didn't know I was the big cheese.
Well, you are the big cheese, aren't you?
That somewhat sounds smelly. No, thank you. Yeah, no, I do feel really old now. It's been a long year, and you know, I wish I had more time to play games. I got all the year end wrap ups, you know, from Xbox, PlayStation, and Nintendo, and I think, you know, it's my playtime is north of 1,500 hours or something across those platforms, and I don't know how I did that with everything else I have to do during the course of the year, and now I feel tired. Thank you.
Yeah.
Shouldn't be so much work.
Well, I was actually going to ask you this, how you actually find time to play games. I mean, a lot of game developers that I speak to, they don't even play games because they just don't have any time, right? So you've obviously got all the content that you're managing at IGN. You're doing a lot of traveling by the sounds of it. Plus, you've got to fit in gaming time, and depending on the game, you know, like let's say Zelda, for example, that's not a short game. And you have to try and fit in all this time. So I have no idea how you do it.
No, so I spent 211 hours on Tears of the Kingdom, which is the longest I spent in a game this year that I saw in the trackers. It's two things. One, this year was busy in that my wife had a lot of travel. I usually don't play games at home when we're hanging out. We want to do things together. She's not a gamer. You know, when the whole family is at home, we play tabletop games and cook together and do other things like that. But when she's traveling, it's boring. I watch lots of horror movies, which she hates. She hates those movies. So I get to watch all of those. And I play a lot of games when she's traveling. And then I myself was traveling a lot. So, you know, flying to our headquarters are in Los Angeles. I'm up in the Bay Area. You know, you get to the airport, you've got 30 minutes to an hour, you're hanging out, flight gets delayed. Thank goodness for the Switch, right? And so I got a lot of playtime in. When I travel, I prefer to play games like Advance Wars, where like it's kind of smaller experiences rather than a big sprawling game like a Zelda. I don't like story games when on the go, so I get a lot of simple gameplay time done when I'm traveling. And then that's why I had more playtime on the Switch this year than the other two platforms. I love my PlayStation 5. I love my Xbox. So, you know, I have a Steam Deck as well. It's too big to carry around. You'll need like a second suitcase just for that thing, and then the battery pack that you need so very quickly. And then, you know, I do have kids who are now, all of them are older than 18. And so when games like Super Mario come out, or Diablo, or Baldur's Gate, we play together. There's multiplayer, so it's family time, and you know, you get to sneak in some hours with the kids.
Yeah. So, do you have to try and plan in advance what games you're going to play throughout the year? Like, because you know, let's say in 2024, you'll know the list of games coming out. But how far ahead would you plan? Be like, okay, I'm going to set time aside for this one and this one, but maybe not this one.
Yeah, and we played Diablo 3 on Switch, and we obviously had to buy the game four times because of that, right? With Diablo 4, it's a little easier. We've got Game Pass subscriptions for everyone in the house, and so you know the boys play on PC. Actually, Diablo 4 wasn't on Game Pass, but with some of the multiplayer games that are on Xbox and PC Game Pass, it's a little easier, and it becomes a little bit more spur of the moment. What we play, but with something like Diablo 4, you have to plan ahead, obviously. And then you know Mario Wonder, one copy of a game, one screen, four controllers. I don't know if this, if you know this, but I have a lot of Joy-Con, so we're all set for that. Yeah, so those are a little bit easier to share.
Yeah. We were talking a little bit off air about the whole working from home, going into the office. Yep. Do you go into the office much, or do you work from home predominantly these days?
So I used to, look, before the pandemic, I went to the office every day. You know, our office was in downtown San Francisco, but then the pandemic hit and we closed it pretty early and shifted to partial work from home. We did, after the pandemic was over, we basically adopted a hybrid model. When we do, you know, when an event is happening, obviously we get together and we run studio productions, and we ran some of those out of San Francisco. But then in the course of the last year and a half, we've really bolstered our presence in LA. It used to be that LA was the small office, and then San Francisco had big studio spaces, three big studios. We abandoned that office because, you know, who wants to sit on paying big rent for 2 years when you can't go in? Yeah. We went to a smaller office for smaller shoots with a one studio set up in San Francisco, and then built up LA, where everybody lives closer, more people are going in. So now we have a 3.5 studio set up in LA. So I just spent the last 2.5 days in LA this week, you know, commuting there. And that's the general setup for people who are on camera. We shoot out of LA most of the time. But it's a hybrid model. There's certainly certain tasks that you can do from home really easily. You know, I oversee, I actually read my job is a little different now. You know, I used to oversee the sort of everything editorial, video production, guides, product realm. I'm on a secret project right now that's a little bit more focused, that has something to do with content and tools. And so a lot of people on that team, you can get all that work done from home.
Right.
It's not the same. It's not, I really like being in a shared space. I love morning stand-up meetings with a content team where, you know, you can talk about the biggest stories of the day and you can instantly assign someone or give feedback on direction, or somebody may spot something and volunteer it. All of that is a little bit harder to do when you do a morning meeting online through Hangout or your Zoom or whatever, right? Where you might have 100 people on, but like, who's going to raise their hand and speak out when they have something to add? Nobody wants to disrupt the flow, right? So you do lose something.
And I suppose it also depends on whether you're extroverted or introverted.
Yeah. I mean, there's a healthy mix definitely within the company, right? Generally, a lot of engineers are a little bit more introverted. Product managers are a little bit more extroverted. Editorial it's a good mix. You know, we have guide writers who are very extroverted and writers who are introverted and vice versa. So it really depends. And that's great.
When was the last time you conducted interviews for someone that wanted to get a job at IGN? Or did you
get a job
that
at IGN?
Yeah, if somebody, like, because obviously I'm assuming there's a panel, right?
Three hours screen ago. Test. Yeah, I interviewed somebody 3 hours ago.
Oh, okay.
And I interviewed somebody late last week for an open position on the content team we have that we extended an offer for. So hopefully that one goes through. Yeah, I'm still involved in definitely a lot of the hiring decisions, but I'm not going to be the one to interview, you know, an inside salesperson or someone outside of my realm, but, you know, certainly on the management side.
Have you got any like weird stories from interviews? I've spoken to a number of game devs and they always have like that one interview where they have someone that says something strange or they do something strange in the interview.
Yes, there are lots. And, you know, I obviously can't share all of them, but
of course.
Or some of them. But they are generally on the content team side. It's people who are genuinely excited to turn their hobby into a job, right? So you get people who are very, very passionate. You sometimes get people who are a little bit starstruck and are because of that are nervous and can't get their point across. And I feel really bad about that. But when recruiting for management positions, sometimes it's abundantly clear when somebody doesn't really give a crap. And like I've had interviews where I'm like, why am I talking to this person? This person doesn't actually want the job, right? It's a waste of both of our times. It's happened. It's always confounding to me.
Maybe like it's just somebody like run of the mill they're just going through a list.
No, yeah. You'll get to the, they're so confident. In some cases, maybe they want the job, but they're so confident that they do zero research, right? Like, they'll give you advice like, well, IGN should really look into TikTok. I'm like, thank you, 4 million followers. You know, but that's, those are the sort of moments where I'm like, I find it really hard to get over that, even if you have a competent person on the other side, you know? It's the same with cold calls and, you know, companies reaching out to you to offer their services. Like, just spend 30 seconds looking at us. Has IGN thought about turning articles into videos?
Yeah.
Like, yeah. Yes. 2.5 billion video views this year. Thank you.
But how do you stay up with all the trends and everything that's happening? Because obviously you have to pivot adapt.
Do I?
Well, I don't know. I assume you do. Would someone have to? I mean, because IGN has managed to stay relatively successful. You know what I mean? Like, the channel adapts as it needs to.
Yeah, look, you have to hire good people. You have to have a good team. You have to surround yourself with people who are smarter than you.
What's it saying? If you're the smartest person in the room, you're in the wrong room.
Yeah, that's right. There you go. Yeah. Maybe. It sure is nice to be the smartest person in the room sometimes, though. Like,
of course,
you kind of need that as an ego booster. No, it's honestly about the team you build, right? And I'm in my early 50s. I am not the prime target audience for TikTok. I open the app and sometimes shake my head as to what the algorithm thinks I would like. But I realize the potential. I realize the challenges, right? It's not a platform that's easily monetized for a media company like ours. I realize that you can't just take what we do on the website and put it on TikTok and expect it to do well. And I have a hunch as to maybe what would do well. But the reason why we succeed there is because we have people on the team who get it. There are people who are in the age group who understand what TikTok is. They are prime users of TikTok. They might never touch Facebook or Instagram, but they're on TikTok and they get it. And so it's about making sure that their opinions are listened to, are shared, are followed, that we experiment a lot. And then, you know, the big thing, I think, is just fearlessness. That the reason why we're big on YouTube today, right, over a billion views served for the last, I don't know how many years, every year consistently, is because we were courageous in the beginning when YouTube was still a website where people shared dog on the skateboard videos or falling into the pool by accident, that sort of stuff, right? It was very much a sort of a viral moments, life moments platform. And we noticed that some of our fans didn't like our video player on the website. Some things never change. And they uploaded IGN videos to YouTube themselves. And some of them were getting a fair amount of views. And we said, okay, instead of just letting people do this and we make no money, let's just upload them ourselves and make no money, because there wasn't a monetization platform, right? But we basically said, there might be long-term impact when you're programming a platform that people will no longer watch those same videos on your website, and you have to be courageous and not look back on something like that. And that was the right bet, right? Even today, there are major entertainment websites that don't put their content on YouTube, or they don't turn their content into video, and who are now struggling with social media because so much video is consumed on social media platforms. So,
yeah,
lots of experiments, you know, new platform like Threads launches. Let's see what's there. Let's try it out. We don't have to, you know, put a full-time person on it, but let's experiment and see if there's a there. And then if there's activity and users are there, let's figure out what they want, what they need on that platform, give it to them and see eventually, maybe we can monetize that. And if not, you can always leave later.
Well, one of the smart things I think you did as well is because you've got IGN, but then on YouTube at least, you've kind of got different channels that cater for different things, right? So you've got like IGN, then IGN Games, and I think you got IGN Nintendo and all these other things.
We did. We have Cinefix, we have a guides channel, we have a main channel, we have a movie trailers one, we have a game trailers one, and we have a games one. And so The word is out whether that's smart or not. We'll see, right? Because algorithms and platforms are constantly changing.
Yes.
We publish podcasts. They're primarily consumed in audio format. GameScoop, NVC, Beyond, Unlocked. Now Cinefix is added to the mix, which is awesome movies podcast you should listen to. And but we also output those as videos and we put them on YouTube. And originally the algorithm had a really hard time getting the right people to those long form videos. So what you got was awesome trailer. Thank you. Awesome review trailer. What is this 1 hour talking heads video? Why are you showing this to me? Right. And so the feedback was negative on those videos and it wasn't a fan audience discovering them. It was console warriors discovering them. So on the PlayStation podcast, you'd get people mad that it was about PlayStation. On Nintendo, you'd get people mad that it was about Nintendo and so forth. And so we said, can we take those experiences, put them in a different place? And we repurposed the channel we had and turned it into the sort of longer form gaming only podcasty channel. And it hasn't really helped those shows grow because obviously being on a smaller channel means fewer chances of a video hitting big with a big subscriber audience. But you are keeping the same type of content in one place and you're attracting a similar kind of audience that loves to watch something for 60 minutes. But we'll see. The algorithm constantly changes. Right now, YouTube is throwing everybody for a loop by favoring shorts, right?
Yep.
Every social media and video platform always wants to be what the other one is. And so TikTok, huge success with short vertical viral videos. Now YouTube wants to do the same. YouTube, big success with long form content. Now TikTok wants to do the same thing, right? So it's this constant like push and pull. What you're seeing on YouTube right now is a lot of algo juice going towards viral shorter videos. That's tough for a lot of YouTubers because they don't really make any money. They just don't. YouTube promises that they will someday, so we'll see. But right now, it's basically every time you produce a short video and it goes viral, you're making a fraction of what you would make with a little bit more effort spent on a longer video. So
it's exactly right. I mean, yeah. I suppose you're in a position where you're not just relying on the algorithm per se because you've got advertisers as well. But like, say for a YouTuber who relies specifically on the algorithm to put food on the table, When they change things, it becomes very, very difficult.
Oh, no. We all rely on the algorithm because you're playing on a borrowed platform. And the same is true with a website, right? As long as a high percentage of visitation comes through Google, you're depending on Google's algorithm. And Google constantly changes things, right?
Yeah.
Now they're stacking the top of search results pages with Google AI generated summaries that don't really send a lot of traffic to websites, right? So these are the sort of challenges that you have to react to in the media business. And obviously we take them seriously. On YouTube, you know, we have, I forget, what do we have? Like 15 million subscribers on the main channel, right? That doesn't mean that your content gets in front of those 15 million people, because then YouTube introduced the bell after a while. It segmented the information again because they realized that they don't have enough churn and discovery of new channels. And so when we publish, IGN is a high volume channel, right? And so that means views sometimes are slow to grow because a subscriber to the IGN channel is not going to get all 40 videos that we upload in a day. YouTube picks based on likelihood and algo and AI, which ones to show to you as a user. And then a lot of the views are generated later through recirculation, algorithm, videos that appear on other channels and so forth. And so, no, I mean, look, we are writing and creating videos for humans. We got to make sure that the stuff we create is trustworthy, it's accurate, it's entertaining, it's targeted, and it's something that the audience wants. But we're also making content for machines. We got to make sure that it's instrumented in the right place and that the right content comes out at the right time and goes on the right platform.
So much to think about, even at the
And it's easy to get cynical about that. I sometimes see people in games media complaining that they're writing for SEO. If you're not, SEO means search engine optimization, which means optimizing your content so that the Google robots discover it and find enough keywords to say it's relevant enough to bring to the top of a results page, right? But writing for SEO is kind of a silly concept because SEO is so that your content gets discovered by people searching for a certain term. And so it's user interest. Like, people are searching for a certain topic. And if you're generating content and it's good and you're helping somebody with a query or a problem they have, then that's just journalism. That's not writing for SEO.
So how are you combating, obviously, the whole ChatGPT thing becoming a phenomenon as it has? Because obviously, you had that incident quite a number of years ago with like Dead Cells and the plagiarism thing. And all that. Yeah. But now obviously you've got this new AI tool that's that can basically write an article or an editorial for you. And so you could end up hiring someone that's using ChatGPT. I mean, you'd probably have to do some
filtering out. I mean, look, AI obviously as a technology is exciting, and it's as much as we complain about AI taking the jobs of humans, it's a little bit the byproduct of any innovation. Anytime we create something that makes work easier or makes processes easier, there is the challenge that it may represent to people who have that job right now. And, you know, usually things adapt and new jobs are formed. And, you know, I always believe that the good side will win in the end. But there is the challenge with AI that it becomes more and more difficult to distinguish originally created thought from machine generated stuff. That's the amalgamation of 1,000 opinions, right? I can tell you, I mean, look, right now, I think it was Washington Post or New York Times report last year that listed the top most crawled websites by AI, and IGN was in the top 100. We're pretty high up because we are an old website with lots of pages, deep strategy guides and all of that. And so there's a lot of information that gets crawled. A lot of big wiki sites also obviously are on the list. So the information that once used to be special can easily be summarized and taken. People used to search for, when is Grand Theft Auto 3 coming out, right? And then IGN would be top of Google search results because we had the answer. We talked to the publisher and we keep our dates up to date and all of that. And then people click through and they find the answer. Now Google just takes the answer from 1,000 websites, says this is the most likely answer based on magic machines, and then tells you the answer. And no longer, you know, there might be a little link somewhere saying here are the web pages that factored into this number, this date, but they no longer really drive a lot of traffic for this sort of stuff. To me, you talked about innovation and kind of keeping pace of what's happening in the industry, keeping ahead of trends. To me, that's an indicator that if you're just a purveyor of facts, you're in trouble. And that's ultimately where viewpoint and tools and, you know, just the voice come in and are very, very important, because those are ultimately defensible. A plagiarist may take the points highlighted in a review and replicate them and put them in their own voice. But usually that sort of stuff comes to the forefront and people realize that that isn't original thought. And especially when, you know, the verbiage is not changed. It is a lot easier to rip off facts. You know,
It is.
The summary of a movie, for example. If you just summarize a movie, it's very easily replicated. And what comes out is not unique because the movie never changes. It's always the same movie. But the meaning of a movie, the meaning of its ending, what are the allegories? What are the references? Like, what, you know, how does that relate to me as a critic in my life and the feelings that I felt for when I watched the movie? Those are much harder to replicate. Not to say that that's all completely safe, but that's why I think outlets worried about AI focus on creating original content that is defensible and unique rather than facts. And then when it comes to plagiarism in general, I mean, I can tell you, I am still more worried about humans. Not a week goes by that we don't see an IGN strategy guide ripped off. Sometimes like an entire table of that we spend a lot of time creating ripped off wholesale by a known gaming website out there that, you know, you would definitely know if I said any of them. And we like to take the high road and we reach out privately and say, hey, that's our information. Either give credit and remove it. They usually just remove it because they don't want to give credit and link back to us. So, but really? that is a real thing that happens all the time. And it's incredibly frustrating. And maybe AI makes it a little bit easier to get ripped off, but maybe AI in the future will make it a little bit easier to find all of the instances of non-original content.
Yeah, well, I've even noticed that with, you know, let's say I do a podcast. I interview a game developer, then a publication picks it up, they write a piece, and then multiple other publications copy that piece and repost it, right? So I can think of an incident. So I spoke to the senior designer of the Metroid Prime trilogy. He talked about how on the original Metroid Prime, he did 110-hour weeks, sometimes 36-hour days, and then that got posted, and then it basically gets compounded. Yeah,
and then look, journalists, I think a lot of journalists do an amazing job citing sources, making sure to link back to the original websites. IGN used to have no follow links for external links. That was an early SEO strategy to kind of like shape your pages and make sure that you don't give link juice and power to external domains. We got rid of all of that. When we link to something, it is discoverable by Google. We want to cite our sources. When we have an image post on Instagram, we put the source in the image because obviously you can't do links there. So we're very careful, but mistakes happen. Right. And like sometimes a journalist may cite a source that already cited the source from somewhere else. And like a story you broke gets regurgitated three times. In the end, the people credited with the story are no longer you. It's the ones that reported on you or discovered you.
Yeah, right? And that's exactly what happened.
So that happens. And like in that case, I think sometimes, those mistakes happen. No, it's the sort of uncredited lifting of information that is obviously a huge challenge. We had we wrote a Mortal Kombat guide. I'll tell you this example. We usually don't talk about that stuff publicly, but we wrote a Mortal Kombat guide, and it was before the game was out. We were invited to the studio. We had an expert player who was freaking amazing in Mortal Kombat. He tested out all the fatalities. He got names for some of them from the devs. Some of them, there were no names. So he created temporary names for the fatalities and wrote how to do them. Day later, on Google, we get outranked by three websites that had the exact list of fatalities with the names that we made up.
Oh, that must be so frustrating.
Yeah, and then we reach out. We're like, hey, that's our information. They're like, no, this is just from the game. We're like, no.
Whatever.
Because we are right now fixing those names to the actual names because the game is out and we're no longer embargoed. And those are not the real names. Those are our inventions. It happens, right?
Well, there's not, I suppose, how do you even combat it? I mean, there's not much you can really do, can you?
Well, you can be Dark Galadriel and go on Twitter and, certainly that's an effective strategy sometimes, right? Where you could complain and you could shame people and then hope that it stops. But look, that's not the way to treat your peers. And you never know, it might be a mistake, or maybe it was user-generated content, or it was a freelancer and all of that. And so our path, where we have time, we reach out privately and we try to resolve the matters. Look, a litigious company could probably make some money off that sort of stuff, but we believe in writers and not lawyers.
Well, yeah, and you're also trying to combat misinformation anyway, which is a bit of a problem. Just period. Like, yeah, and then so look, much misinformation. I've seen all the memes and all this, critical stuff people say.
And
about,
it can happen. No, for sure. And it can happen to you, right? Like we do take great care to make sure that we credit sources, and there are news articles every day that credit sources that are visible and explicit. But all it takes is for one mistake to slip through a new freelancer who may have made a mistake or something, or even somebody experienced, like accidentally deletes something or doesn't cite the right source. So instead of throwing glasses, right? They never throw glasses. Glasses are beautiful. Instead of throwing rocks and maybe damaging some windows, but your own glass house as well, I'd say just try to resolve things and hopefully people learn quietly.
How do you keep a good relationship with, say, studios or publishers, right? Let's say some scandal happens and you report on it. Maybe you break the news and that annoys maybe the publisher. Because I know, there are some YouTubers that's what they do. They just review games.
Yeah.
And then if they give a game a bad score, then sometimes they get blacklisted. That wouldn't happen to you because you're way too big for that team.
What are you talking about? Of course it happens.
Really?
Oh, yeah, of course it happens. Yeah, it hasn't happened recently. I think the world has changed a little bit, but I mean, there were companies in the early days. I can tell you one because it's out of business and, you know, the reboot has nothing to do with it. But THQ, we pissed off the head of THQ to the point was it Homeworld? No, what was it? One of the shooters, they had a Call of Duty killer and we didn't love it. And they were so pissed off. They pulled all the advertising in an effort to strong arm us into covering it more favorably. The trick is, you know, we as managers knew about it, but didn't tell our writing team. We don't want anybody to be biased against the company based on a move like that, right? So we don't even pass it along. But they pulled their ads and then they didn't send any code anymore. Well, it happens.
Well, that leads... I can see where conspiracy comes from then of people like buying review scores, right?
You know, that doesn't happen because if you run a good editorial team and you have sound processes, you're fortified from it, right? So, I mean, what you're saying is generally true is that IGN is a major publication. If somebody blackballs us and doesn't talk to us, it ultimately means they're not in the news as much anymore. And obviously they see some value in being covered by us, even if they weren't happy with the review score. But what's the fallout if they don't send us a game anymore? It's meaningless. It's okay. It's inconvenient in that we have to review the game a couple of days later, but it's not gonna break the company, right? So, sometimes publishers don't send you code because they know the game is bad. Sometimes they don't send you code because the game isn't done yet, right? And might actually raise suspicions in that case. Sometimes those suspicions are warranted, right? When the last gen console versions of Cyberpunk weren't sent, and we told people, hey, we only have the next gen version, and so we can't judge the old ones, and then they turned out to have some real issues. The weapon journalists have, if you want to call it that, is that we can report on the things that are happening. So if a company doesn't send us advanced copies, we can say, and I don't mean this to sound like blackmail, but we can tell our audience, hey, we didn't get an early copy of this game, so we can't give you a review right now. So maybe wait a couple of days for our assessment if you want our viewpoint on it. Why would any publisher want to play that game? That just seems like, it seems risky, right?
Yeah. So yeah. Does that still happen these days though? Like, are you still, you don't have the blacklisting like you, the whole incident with THQ, that would have been, well,
that's ages ago. Yeah. Before THQ Nordic rebooted it. I can't think of there hasn't been a recent case, but I think most recently it was probably a movie studio doing it. But again, it's like, it's silliness, right? It's, if we don't get access to a screener, our review is what, 8 hours later? It doesn't make a difference.
Yeah.
It's not something I think publishers have evolved, and maybe it's because of having to deal with social media and how much more directly accessible they are. And I think everybody, because publishers, studios are much more in the limelight right now. I think they're treading more lightly. If you go back 15 years, a company like THQ didn't have a social offering. They had a website with information about their games, but that was the only interaction they had with the audience, is passive. Users went to their website, learned about their games, and that's it. Now they have dialogue. Publishers promote themselves on social media. They sometimes hire writers from IGN, ex-writers, to create content or be on camera playing games and doing Let's Plays, all of that, right? So game publishers and developers are much more like media than they've ever been before. But, you know, they're preaching to the choir, and they obviously are an extension of their marketing engine. And so there's this back and forth, and they're in the limelight, and they want to be beloved. They want to be liked. And so the way to be liked is to not ruffle feathers, you know, cutting off YouTubers and getting them mad at you, or cutting off media and getting them mad at you. That's not a good strategy.
Yeah, I suppose it's walking the fine line. But say, let's say with Gamergate, right? That became a bit of a political thing. So how does IGN navigate that? Because if you pick a side, you're going to end up pissing off one group of people, right? So, I mean, so with anything that becomes political, do you try and just stay away from it as much as you can?
Well, I mean, I don't think journalists don't have to pick a side, right? They're obviously
op-eds
and opinions, and you know, you can report on stuff, but you know,
but it gets viewed as taking a side, particularly if people have an emotional attachment.
But in Gamergate, if you're media, the audience already says you have a side, right? So there wasn't really any dealing with that, and there was some just horribly misogynist, stuff being spewed as part of that, and whatever legitimate concern there was about, you know, journalists being influenced by relationships or anything like that was quickly lost and just kind of turned into this sort of anti-media, anti-critics bull. No, like, how do you navigate that? I mean, look, I think the core thing for journalists to aim for is to be trusted, right? And you're trusted by demonstrating their processes. You want to make sure that you're open, that you have a dialogue with your audience, but also that you position yourself not as a voice of the publishers or the developers, but as a voice of the people. And you do that by covering the things that the people are interested in. I mean, as for example, you can report on microtransactions and say they're really good for publishers because they make a lot of money. Or you can say, but they're really bad for consumers because they are now paying $70 for a game and now they have to pay extra on it, right? And so I think as a journalist, you have to walk that fine line sometimes between saying the reason why they're doing this is X, but it really sucks for gamers and we don't like it, right? And so that it's just about focus and making sure you're clear about what side of the mouth you're talking about, and whether you're explaining a business model or you're saying that's a great business model or that's a great thing for gamers, right?
Yeah. You've done a lot of interviews, but I actually haven't heard you discuss this, but I'm curious as to when you moved from Germany to America, was there culture shock initially, or were you able to assimilate into the culture quite easily? I mean, I know you spent some college years in Japan as well.
Yeah, yeah.
So was that like a good stepping stone in a way?
Yeah, I think I've mentioned this before. I never quite felt like I belonged in Germany. Honestly, growing up as a teenager, I always thought I wanted to move somewhere else. I really liked France too. Italy is awesome. I love Germany, and I'm there are lots of things about me that are very German besides the accent. You know, whether it's the love for beer or the food, or you know, the sort of love of certain types of art or landscapes and all of that. But no, I really felt like I belonged in the US. Japan was a little bit of a detour, and I absolutely adore Japan. And you know, I go to Japan probably once a year now. My daughter studied there for a few years too. But no, America just felt right.
Hmm. And how good's your Japanese? Just out of curiosity.
It's all right now. I mean, it's been since I lived there. I lived there in 1990. So it's been a little bit. My wife's bilingual. She speaks Japanese. She was born in Miyazaki in southern Japan, so I can get around. My reading sucks now. You know, I played a lot of video games in Japanese. Like I played Final Fantasy 4, 5, and 6 entirely in Japanese, so I had to learn a lot of kanji, like the kanji for cave or bat or goblin, you know. So I learned some out there kanji, but I probably couldn't write them anymore. I can still read dokutsu and komori and all those things. So I can still read.
That's good. So yeah. No problem. No,
but, Yeah, and then with the move to America, I obviously like I think the East Coast is a lot more European and a lot more like Germany, right? And California is a little bit farther removed, but I think that just also attracted me to it. It was so different. It looked like the stuff I knew from the movies, and I can't beat the weather, man.
Well, particularly
can beat it now, but yeah.
Yeah, yeah. Well, and I suppose America's so vast, right? It pretty much offers everything.
Yeah.
If you go around here, there, and everywhere, which I suppose you've been here, there, and everywhere at this point.
I have not. Look, I've been to quite a few different states, right? Everything from on the West Coast to Colorado, Utah, Texas, Florida, New York, and Massachusetts and stuff. But I have some huge gaps. I've been to Nebraska too.
Wow.
That was a student exchange in high school. Actually, I went to Nebraska, but there are a couple of states that I haven't been to that I would love to go.
Such as?
A lot of places in the center of the country. I've only flown over Arizona, for example. I've not been to Maine, where the great Seth Macy resides, for example. I haven't been to Wisconsin, even though they make the best cheese in America, the closest thing that we have in Europe. So there are a couple of places I want to go.
I mean, last month, obviously, you were traveling quite a lot. So how the heck do you maintain your energy? Because I suppose there's subtle time differences as well, if you're going between different time zones. But I suppose it depends where, like, are you flying from one coast to the other? Or is it somewhere that's...
Well, we run a study every 2 years that we share with clients. And then, next year we're going to take it on tour with PR people as well. That in this case, it's a study about gamer behaviors. That we used to do with Nielsen, we do with GBK now, where we segment the gamer audience and showcase, like the old split between core and casual gamer. It's gotten a lot more complicated. And so we walk through, how Gen Z differs from other demographics and their sort of platform preferences, likes, dislikes. So we did a tour where our publisher and I present the findings to clients. And that could be anyone from, major game companies to advertisers, agencies, advertising, client agencies and stuff. And so, yeah, we would hit up New York and Boston in one go. And we've got a bunch of them planned. And then we take a little break. I don't do a tour where I just constantly go from state to state. I'd be very, very naked. Tired.
Yeah.
No.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah. That's after a couple of presentations, I lose my voice too, so that wouldn't work.
Is it just because you're talking so loud?
I am very loud. No, it's just talking so much. A presentation is like an hour of talking, so nonstop, and you do that, and then you go out to dinner, and you have to. Restaurants in America are very loud. You have to yell over the music and everything.
Yeah, they are.
Yeah. So yeah. And I've never been to New Zealand. I've never been to Australia. I was going to go visit our Australian office.
Is it Sydney or
Sydney.
Melbourne? Yeah.
Sydney, yeah. And I've got some friends, in New Zealand and in Australia and other places like Perth and stuff too.
It's just a bit of a mission to fly.
It's just a little far.
I was at PAX Australia because I hosted something there in October, and that was a 4-hour flight from where I was. Yeah, and that's just to Australia. Yeah. So flying anywhere takes me ages.
4 hours is nothing. That's less than going to New York.
Well, that's the smallest flight I can get anywhere, okay, right? Okay, so that's the small side.
Fair enough.
Yeah, flying anywhere. Like if I was to fly to LA, I think that's about 15 hours, I think.
Yeah, that's an hour for me.
So easy,
yeah,
easy.
A little more convenient. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Do you think there could ever be a fourth competitor? Or do you think it's going to contract somewhat?
The consoles?
Yeah, because obviously there's the competition is so fierce. And I think Amazon have tried and Google have tried.
It seems like the market really wants to. Because I would say that the Xbox and PlayStation are very similar, right?
They are.
That's not to say that obviously Xbox has awesome franchises that aren't on PlayStation. PlayStation has awesome ones that aren't on Xbox. But there's a huge difference between Nintendo and Xbox and Nintendo and PlayStation, but not between PlayStation and Xbox.
Yes.
And I mean, what I thought before the Activision acquisition, I thought Microsoft would accelerate towards a streaming subscription platform where Game Pass would be a service that you get everywhere, right? They certainly have a strong lineup of developers. I mean, that's like, it's the Netflix model, right? Where if you want Stranger Things, you got to subscribe to Netflix. And I thought that's where Xbox was going to go, but then all of the legal wranglings around not becoming a monopoly in streaming, I think, are pushing back on that a little bit. And so it sounds like everybody's going to be making consoles for a while. But I think it'll be three. There'll be an Ouya or something like that popping up, but not really getting through anymore. And, you know, before it was, I mean, let's face it, the only ones who could launch a platform would have been the big TV and electronics manufacturers like you know, Matsushita Panasonic or something like that, Pioneer and all that. That's Matsushita Denki, Japanese company. But they built the hardware for other companies or big game studios like your Activisions and EAs. And they're not interested in that. The profit margins of the hardware business are much lower than the software business.
Well, that's why Sony and Microsoft traditionally sell at a loss and try to make it back on games, right? Whereas Nintendo doesn't do that. Yeah.
No. And look, depending on chip prices, obviously that shifts for the other two as well. But yeah, I mean, look at Epic. Epic's got the biggest game on the market. Fortnite is becoming a platform. Fortnite is a console. It's just there's no box, right? You're going to boot up Fortnite and every character from everything is in there except Nintendo. And now you can play Lego in it and you can play Rock Band in it and you can play racing games in it. And it's just going to keep expanding. You can play user-made games in it. It's the sort of Epics and the Robloxes of the world that are closest to what consoles are really now. But they're not going to make a box.
Too expensive. No. What's IGN's philosophy when it comes to leaks? Like, let's say you manage to obtain a whole bunch of information that was correct about the Switch 2, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. Would you publish it or would you wait? Would you discuss it with Nintendo first?
Oh, I see. Look, I mean, I can't answer that on behalf of the editorial team, right? Like, John, our publisher, is leading that team now and is shaping the, you know, the approach and the policies there. Traditionally, you know, what I would have done is when we get a leak of information, we definitely want to go to the source. We would go to the source and say, here's what we have. Can you confirm it or deny it? Most of the time that doesn't result in anything.
No comment will probably be the answer.
And then we have to have things validated by multiple sources. We don't publish something based on a single source. So we would have to validate it and get somebody else to go on the record. That's what we did back in the days when things like, you know, we got the Metroid Prime leak that it was going to be first person and what it was going to look like. We needed two people to tell us that that was true and the direction before we ran the story. And that still holds true, that we need multiple sources. But now there's also the precedent that you have to tread lightly when it comes to legal matters, right? Back in the Wild West days of the internet, you could have grabbed a slide from a leaked document and put it online. You can really get your publication into trouble net right now, because if you're accused of disclosing company secrets, or you know there's copyrighted information in there, like if you're distributing an image that you explicitly don't have the right to host, you can get in trouble. So you have to be careful. So the inner workings of reporting on a leak would be: verify the information, figure out if it's true, try to get the official source to comment. You know, if the official source doesn't comment, that doesn't mean that you don't write it, right? You want to pursue the story. And then you got to run it by a legal head and see what you can do.
Mm. Mm-hmm. Does IGN take credit for Nintendo making a live-action Zelda film? considering that you guys
no, absolutely not. Absolutely
who knows?
Not.
They may have no. referenced that when they were thinking about it.
If look, considering how long it took for them to make one, maybe you had the opposite effect and they said, oh, this looks like crap, let's not make one.
Was it 15 years ago, wasn't it? Was it 15 years ago that you guys did that video?
I don't know. What is time? No, it's I thought they would do Zelda as an animated show.
So and
like
I.
you see stuff like Blue Eye Samurai on Netflix, you're like, oh, that's what it should look like, you know.
Yeah.
Maybe not as much blood and finger cutting and stuff. But I was actually surprised that they're doing live action.
Yeah, so was I. Yeah. I thought they'd do the whole animated thing, they'd follow in the steps of Mario.
Because the creatures, obviously, you can CG everything, but like characters like Ganon are tough to pull off, I think. Like where, you know, pull off in a way where you go, that looks like the thing that I have in my mind. And even Link, very difficult to pull off, voice or no voice, right? I don't know, we'll see. I'm excited. Look at The Last of Us, that was beautiful.
Yeah, it was. And adaptations of video games are getting better and better now. I mean, there used to be what's known as the video game movie curse, right? Where
Uwe Boll, right? The German director, he just kind of, it was more like a tax write-off than an intent to actually make good movies. It was the same hump that comic book movies had to get over. I grew up as a kid excited with Spider-Man and Thor and loved the Fantastic Four and always wondered, why don't we get these as movies and TV shows? And then we got one. We're like, oh, that's why. It took Tim Burton and Batman to break that curse. And suddenly, you know, and then it didn't quite go for, like, we still didn't get a real Spider-Man. We still didn't get Marvel. And then it took the MCU to break that curse once and for all. And now what used to be niche characters, like you could walk around town and show somebody an Iron Man comic book 20 years ago and they wouldn't have known who the character is. Now it's a $1 billion movie franchise. Each movie makes $1 billion and it's everybody recognizes Iron Man. That's going to happen with video games.
It will.
Yeah.
I mean, I do wonder what they're going to do. Because are they going to shoot it on the volume? Are they going to shoot it on set? How much of it is CGI? How much of it isn't?
It'll be a lot of CGI, for sure.
I personally think they should shoot it in New Zealand just because The Lord of the Rings was done here and it was, you know, the fantasy
setting.
So
you can tell that the Nintendo Zelda team are huge fans of Lord of the Rings because Twilight Princess came out after Peter Jackson's films and it had like the wild boar-like warg riding. It had scenes that looked very much like Lord of the Rings. And so I think that's the look and the style they love. I think surprised. They
even said that during development. Yeah. They referenced Lord of the Rings. I think Miyamoto even said to reference it. I think I remember reading it somewhere. Yeah.
There you go.
Yeah.
Yeah, so we'll see.
We'll see what happens. Yeah. Are you hanging out for Metroid Prime 4? Or are you over it at this point?
Do you mean, will I still be alive when that game comes out? Well, I don't know anymore. No, look, I think Metroid Prime Remake was a nice little...
Oh, it was amazing.
A nice little reminder for us how good retro can be and how good retro was. And I think for them, it was a project to really get to grips with the franchise again and get a feel for it again and like... They do half as well with Metroid Prime 4. I'd be happy. I'm very excited for it. Is it coming for this Switch? No, it's going to be the next one, right?
You reckon?
I figure, yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
I think the next Switch is going to be a hardware upgrade and not a revamp, right? There are the pictures of some Nintendo patents with like dual screens that can be taken apart. I don't think that's Switch 2. I think Switch 2 is going to be like Switch. And it's not going to be a DS. It's going to be like Switch, but more powerful to allow for more up-to-date games on it. And I think Metroid Prime will be a showcase.
I hope they do like the Super Nintendo route, right? From the original NES. Just upgrade the specs and the hardware. I don't think you really need to change anything. I mean, it's a perfect model the way it works.
It happened with the Wii and the Wii U is a little bit that step forward, right? Even though we got a screen, it really, the Wii U looks and feels and smells like a Wii. And now that we're on Switch, I feel like the next thing is going to be an upgrade from a Switch and not a complete different direction, not a complete redo.
Yeah. I mean, the Wii U's biggest hurdle, I think, was marketing, really. I mean, I felt sorry for Reggie during that time because he was having to spin everything to make it sound good. And I suppose it's a very difficult position to be in.
You know what? I think it's more than just marketing. I hear you. It was difficult to explain to people that it wasn't just a new controller and was actually a new console. But lineup-wise, it didn't have the heavy hitters that people at that time wanted to play. The tablet design, I don't think, was very attractive. It looked like a toy. It looked chintzy, and it had lots of fingerprints at all times. The menus, I don't know if you remember this, when you first got your Wii U, it was sluggish.
Yeah.
Everything took forever. As cool as that sort of community screen was with like the little people running in, it took forever to do anything and to switch between the screens. You couldn't even power it on with just the TV off and all of that. It was a bit of a mess. And then the core gimmick was that you could play... that you had games that would play on two screens, and very few games outside of Nintendo Land really demonstrated that in the best way. Yeah, it was more convenient to have a map screen or an inventory screen on the small screen, but was it necessary? I feel the same way about the touchpad on the PlayStation controller. Who really wants to swipe on that thing? Give me a break. We just all use it like a giant button.
Yeah.
Put a button there then.
Yeah, I do think that the Wii U's failure led to the Switch, though. So in some ways, it was probably a necessity in order to get the Switch, because they probably had that idea in mind, but maybe the technology didn't exist at that time, or it was too expensive.
It definitely didn't.
Yeah.
And even when the Switch came out, we kind of doubted that they'd be able to do a portable / console hybrid at a cost effectively that wouldn't run out of battery so fast, right? And I think they wanted the battery to last longer and they made a compromise. But I thought the Switch turned out way better than any of us expected. And now it's what? It came out in 2017. It's getting a little long in the tooth.
Yeah.
You know, I mentioned our segmentation study earlier when we asked what platforms do you own? Switch shows up really high, right? It's got an install base north of like 130 million now or something.
Well, it's the
right?
third best-selling console ever now.
Yeah, right? But when we ask what's your preferred platform, only 13% of gamers said it's Switch. It's just getting long in its tooth and it needs a refresh.
Yeah, so hopefully that comes soon. I imagine they'll wait till after Christmas and New Year's and then they'll announce something. That's what I'm thinking.
Yeah, but that would be nice.
We'll see, yeah. I'll wrap up in a bit, but I'll just I wanted to ask if there's one thing that you think people misunderstand about IGN. What do you think the number one thing would be that people seem to assume or get wrong?
I mean, look, there's this on YouTube. The you brought it up earlier, right? Like this sort of paid reviews thing is kind of a hilarious misdirect, because it really was born out of the fact that on platforms like YouTube, the content creator and the salesperson are the same people. If you're a YouTuber and you make a huge video, you make more money. If you're an IGN editor and you make a huge video, you make the same amount of money.
True.
We have salaried employees, we have freelancers who are being paid per project. We don't pay people based on the views, and we don't directly benefit from generating more views, right? And so the thing that people don't understand is, even though we play on those platforms, we play on viral platforms like TikTok, we play on YouTube, we are a classic editorial outlet, and that includes the checks and balances. We have a separation of what we call church and state. We don't know which one is editorial, whether it's church or it's the state, and which one is sales, but we separate those processes. And there's an editorial leader, and then there's a sales leader. And the two don't really meet in the sort of planning and processes and keep things separate. And there's an understanding that if we don't like a game and we give it a bad score, that could have an impact on the advertising business, but that is the price of doing business in the editorial realm. And the only way to grow audience is to consistently earn and renew consumer trust. If you let it slip, if you have, you know, if you remember the whole Gerstmann-gate thing with GameSpot, where honestly, some idiot exec decided to fire someone because their voice was too incendiary, or, you know, people tie it to one review. I don't know exactly what happened there, but like somebody got fired over pissing off an advertiser. When something like that happens, it can have years of damage, and no outlet in their right mind would ever want that. And so the misperception that publishers exert a lot of pressure is just the one prevalent misconception that bugs me. It's very difficult to get around that because the audience becomes an echo chamber. They tell each other, right? I see this all the time. It's like, we gave Call of Duty a less than stellar review this year. And then the comments are like, well, of course IGN would give it a less than stellar review because they're owned by Microsoft now. And IGN doesn't like Microsoft. I'm like, where's this even come from?
Yeah.
It got a less than stellar review because we didn't like the game this year. And we've demonstrated again and again, and obviously we just gave Hi-Fi Rush a 9 and it's nominated for Game of the Year. So obviously it's not that we don't like Xbox either. But it's that sort of, you know, when the audience kind of runs with a conspiracy and then just kind of piles on. And then in some cases, YouTube influencers even amplify that and do the sort of thing that Tucker Carlson always does with, I'm just asking questions, you know. You have to do more than just ask questions. You also have to understand how journalism works and what checks and balances are in place. We have, if you go to corp.ign.com on our corporate website, I know corporate, but it's where we house a lot of our documentation and our policies. And you can see our policies disclosed, how things work, how reviews are done, how reviews are assigned, what the numbers mean, what happens if a reviewer knew, let's say a former IGN editor now works for a game publisher and is roommates with someone who covers the game. Like, what happens, right? And all the sort of checks and balances that we have in place to account for that, counter that, and make sure that our processes are separate and protected. But all of that documentation doesn't actually make it into the mainstream, right? People don't seek out that information. It's easier to go like, all games media is paid for, right? Like, it's the easy explanation that if you didn't love a game that I absolutely love, it's easy to say that you're wrong because XYZ, than to just concede and say we have different tastes.
It's a good way of summing up.
Yeah, it's a big topic. I could talk about that stuff for ages, but you know, the takeaway, I don't want the takeaway to be that everyone is wrong and, you know, we're always right. It's like we can have a review, we can have a negative review of a game where maybe the majority of IGN editors goes, "Oh, I actually like that game a lot better." We're not a hive mind. We're a bunch of different gamers with different tastes, but we obviously have to have one representative review because we can't have 10 people reviewing the same game. Otherwise, we wouldn't be able to review as many games as we do, right?
Well, I was going to say,
gamers wouldn't be served. Yeah.
Well, if you've got some of those like top 100 lists, right? Where 100 games on Super Nintendo, and I'm sure there's a whole bunch of you that sit there for hours, deliberating, trying to decide what the list should be.
No, for sure. Yeah. And there are always games on there where I'm like, I don't like, don't be mad, anyone. I don't like the Ninja Gaiden games. I just don't like them, especially the 3D ones. I think Team Ninja, I swear, man, Team Ninja, somebody's mother got killed by a camera because they really have it out for cameras. I could never get into those games, but there are people who love those games. I think IGN gave Gaiden 3 a 9 as well, right? But I have to concede that I'm a different gamer. And some gamers love roguelikes. I'm not a big roguelike fan. I love Metroidvanias where I unlock a map and I populate the map and I clear out rooms. And some people want that sort of the ability to go back and get better and they're probably way more skilled than I am at games. And I think more people need to realize that that is the crux of any sort of disagreement. And At IGN, once in a while, I see somebody go like, well, IGN gave God Hand a 3. I'm like, Jesus, what was that? 1895, an editor who hasn't worked here for 20 years gave that game a bad review. As an editor, Mitchell loves God Hand, who works at IGN, right? That sort of realization that nothing is a hive mind, but obviously, in the interest of time, we put forward opinions by singular people. We also have op-eds with different viewpoints on different topics. And all of those viewpoints should enrich your experience. A negative review of a game you love does not turn the game bad, and it does not take away from your opinion of the game.
Well, people get obsessed with the Metacritic score, I find.
Yeah, which is meaningless, right? That is an amalgamation of different viewpoints, and the source of the information is obfuscated. Like, there may be a 9 from a huge RPG expert on Baldur's Gate 3. And then maybe a 3 from someone who has never played a video game before and is a first-time writer for a smaller website. And the two are equated and are exactly the same, right, in that system. So I think I'm not an aggregator hater, by the way. I love Rotten Tomatoes too, but I think it's way more nuanced than like creating a number, generalizing and taking that as the end all be all, because we're all humans with different opinions and different likes and dislikes. And I don't know if the people who review Advance Wars Remake are as big Advance Wars fans as I am. And so it is important that we engage with the critics and the people writing those opinions, take a look at actually what's written and not just judge everything based on a score. Starfield's a great example. Dan gave it a 7. That means it's a good game. He has got some real issues with it, but he lauds it for a lot of things, including the sort of universe and world creating. But the story out there is that it's a negative review. It's not, right?
It's yeah, and people are saying it's a bad game because it didn't get in the 90s in Metacritic.
People wanted it a 9, right? Wanted it to be a 9 based on their preconceived notions. And our reviewer is a huge fan of Skyrim and the other Bethesda RPGs and wanted it to be a 9 too, right? He was a fan, would have loved for it to be better because ultimately this is the game he experienced and he fanned over and would have loved to like better. But credit to him for not buckling under the pressure of fans saying this must be great, otherwise I will hate you, right? Like, he didn't buckle in, he gave it his honest opinion. And in addition to a score that says it's a good game and it's a 7, which based on your interpretation, you can say then it's not for me or it is for me. There's a whole review that breaks down why he arrived at that number. And that review also tells you that he didn't like the items, the inventory system, and it's frustrating. And I agree with him. I walk around, I'm like, is that weapon better than the weapon I have? Because, oh God, I don't have it equipped right now. How can I compare? And it's worth calling out that games like Borderlands solved this issue years ago, right? And a gamer may look at that and go like, I don't care. I'm the kind of person who loves going into menus and spending time, or I just ignore all the pickups and only upgrade every couple of hours. And so to them, that comment is really valuable because they know whether they'll like that experience or not. And the number is just not as meaningful.
Mm. It must be hard, though, because some of these reviewers, they have to review these games that are like 100 hours, or they can be 100 hours, and so they have to bang it out within a certain time to get the review out, right? Yeah.
Most of the time, they have enough time, though. I mean, that's the nice thing about having early access is that we do get to play the games early enough to be able to take that time.
Yeah.
Sometimes we get multiple copies and then we have multiple people playing and checking them out and like talking to each other. And so there's also sort of reviewer feedback with each other and pointing out things that one person might have missed. So, but that said, you know, we've had games that the publishers haven't sent us. And so the audience gets really mad when there's not a day one review, but we say, hey, here's a review in progress. We have a review diary. We'll share with you what we've experienced. And hopefully some of that is already guidance enough to give people the sort of, should I wait or should I jump in on day one guidance?
Mm. Well, Pierre, I will wrap up there. I'll give you some family time back.
Excellent. Thank you. Yeah. It's actually meeting time. I have another meeting.
Oh, you have another meeting. Okay. Well, yeah. Take care. Great talking to you. And I'm sure I'll see you at some point.
Yeah.
I'm supposed to be, it might not happen, but I might be doing a special thing at PAX West nice. Next year with ex-Retro Studios devs to celebrate the 20th anniversary of Metroid Prime 2 and the 10th That's anniversary amazing. Of Tropical Freeze. So PAX have agreed to it, but they just need to allocate budgets and see if it's going to work. So I won't know for sure until April.
Amazing. I want to go to that. That sounds so good.
Yeah, yeah. So I'll if it happens and you're in Seattle, yeah, I'll buy you coffee or something.
Yeah, look, and if before then you're in San Francisco, please let me know. Sure. Let me know. We'll get together.
Yep, sounds good. All right, well, awesome. I'll let you go, Pierre. Take care.
Have a good one. Take care. See ya.